RadioInfluence.com.
Welcome to the December 4th, 2019 edition of the MMA Report Podcast with Daniel Galvan. I am Jason Floyd, and come here on this week's edition of the show. Daniel's going to tell you a little bit what the vibe is like in the Rio Grande Valley right now, as, of course, that'll be the host of Saturday's Combates pay-per-view, Tito Ortiz versus Alberto Del Rio. So Daniel will give you a little taste of what's going on there. And of course, last week we debuted a new segment called Fight Flashback. And this week we're going to take a look back at a Tito Ortiz fight. And we're going to go back to Bellator 120 when he took on Alexander Shlemenko. As I was in the building on press row, I'll talk about kind of what I remember about that week there in the Memphis area. Then we're going to talk about some of the fight bookings that have been announced by the UFC, as it's looking like they're going to have a tremendous first quarter of 2020. Then you're going to hear my conversations with Ben Saunders and Tyson Chartier. Of course, Ben Saunders going to be fighting next week at UFC 245, taking on Matt Brown. And Tyson Chartier is a manager and a coach, and one of his clients will be fighting next week, Rob Font. Of course, last week on the show, we talked to Rob's opponent, Ricky Simon, so we'll get a little feel what's going on with the camp of Rob Font. You'll hear my conversation with Tyson, who also talks about a lot of his other clients with Top Game Management. And then we're going to wrap up this week's edition of the show by talking about Saturday's UFC Fight Night card in D.C. We'll talk about what fights interest us the most, under the radar fights, and various other things that we're looking forward to. But Daniel, we want to get this show kicked off by talking about the Combates card, which is, for those of our listeners that may not be aware, Daniel does live down in the Rio Grande Valley. And, kind of want to start the show off with, just simply, Daniel, what is the vibe in the Rio Grande right now for this card?
I can't tell you that Tito Ortiz and Alberto Del Rio have taken the Rio Grande Valley by storm, Jason. I can't tell you it feels like a big-time Super Bowl in the RGV. We may not get too many sporting events, but it doesn't mean we're desperate. And so it doesn't feel like it's a big-time event. People are talking about it. Again, at my workplace, we have a big event on Saturday. It's like a big parade. And so the talking point around there is how everyone's disappointed they can't go to the fight because we got to go to the parade. Across town, there are posters on the radio. When you listen to local radio, it's talked about occasionally. This is a combat sports town. We really do love our combat sports, our mixed martial arts. We have a lot of good boxers here. So cards like these will usually do well down here. And people are certainly talking about it and somewhat excited, especially to see Tito Ortiz fight. I feel as though Alberto Del Rio's name certainly resonates well, because this is also a pro wrestling town in terms of, like, when Eddie Guerrero was in the WWE, and when Rey Mysterio was the champion, the shows down here sold so many tickets. So Hispanics love watching wrestling, and they know who Del Rio was. So overall, Jason, I will say that people are talking about this card, but this absolutely isn't going to be a big-time success. When you look at tickets available on the Ticketmaster, I mean, they're available in every section. And in most sections, you got like 40 plus or 50 plus tickets available. And in a lot of sections, it's 100 plus tickets available. So, there's only one floor section and VIP seats that are all sold out on Ticketmaster. So when you watch this event on stream, I think you won't be particularly impressed with the turnout. Although I think they've sold enough tickets to feel halfway decent about it.
I know, like, here in Tampa, Tampa is what I would classify as a walk-up town, for the most part. Most events, you get a lot of people who just, they're trying to buy tickets day of event. Is that what is in the Rio Grande Valley, where you think that maybe all of a sudden Saturday gets here and that maybe, people say, hey, you know what? Hey, let's go see this fight.
Yeah, 100%. That's the since forever, but I knew it early. Reading about those same wrestling events that would come down here, border towns, Hispanic towns in Texas historically are big walk-up towns. And now I don't know if things are changing. That's been the reputation for a while, and that's what I expect to happen. Although, again, the things change, and the online use of ticket purchasing you know, continues, like the scales are tipping for it more in the way of pre-ordering stuff. Like the same walk up town in 2005 might not be that way in 2019. So the Valley, I think, is definitely going that way. When I go to events, it's not like I see at this particular arena, the Paint Arena, it's not like I see long lines at the ticket office when I'm walking into events. But predominantly, yes, Hispanic border towns in Texas, they're big walk-up towns. You'll look at your pre-sales and you'll be like, damn, we are not running here again. And then you'll run the event and they will sell really well because it's a lot of people day up. So I would expect that as well. Again, to me, as a resident that lives in this area, I feel like people are aware of this event, but it's certainly not something that's over being like, oh, like everyone's ready. Like it's just people are aware, but I don't know if the promotion was able to penetrate the overall consciousness of people in this area where like everyone's hyped and ready to go to this event. So again, I think the walk will be halfway decent, but I think the crowd will be okay. I just don't think it will be like a two thumbs up, A plus success. It won't be a failure in my mind either. But I would expect something that's definitely middle of the road in terms of they'll find a silver lining in however many people they draw, even though it's probably not ideally what they would have wanted for Tito Ortiz versus Alberto Del Rio with all the titles on the line.
Yeah, it's, you know, I mean, look, in terms of the actual fight, you know, one of the things you have to mention when you talk about Alberto Del Rio or Alberto El Patron Rodriguez is he has, you know, 14 professional mixed martial arts fights, you know, has a record of 9-5. Seven of his nine wins have come by submission because he hasn't, you know, he hasn't fought in over 9 years. February 27, 2010 was his last fight. You know, I think one of the questions I kind of have with this fight is it is a contract weight of 210 pounds. You know, kind of makes you wonder, you know, how much weight, you know, Alberto is having to cut. I mean, you know, and, you know, the other kind of, to me, you know, one of the things I've always said is I really don't believe you should mix politics and sports. And I feel like all this week and, you know, seeing some of the promotion that Tito is doing is that I feel like Tito is bringing politics into this. I mean, you know, everyone knows Tito is a big supporter of President Trump, but I feel like it just for me, I don't like that aspect of how promoting the fight. You know, I feel like it's, you know, I mean, look, I don't think this thing's going to sell well on pay-per-view. I mean, look, I will never sit here and tell our listeners whether you should or should not buy a pay-per-view. That's a personal decision. For me, it's a total pass. I have no interest in paying $30 to watch this fight because, I mean, you look at, you know, when we were talking before we started recording the show is, you know, you look at that undercard, there is not a lot of names that I think are familiar names to the mixed martial arts fan. You know, you can look at someone like a Gaston Renault. That's a name I think people would know. I think Ray Trujillo is probably a name people would know, you know, particularly from his LFA days, but there's not a lot of name value on the undercard. And to me, I mean, you know, look, if this pay-per-view was $15, I think you've got a better chance of pushing sales. I think of the $30 range and the fact of there is a UFC card on ESPN on Saturday night, I think that's going to hurt it as well. You know, and I know we've talked about this before, but and particularly with this event is it just has that feel that they're just trying to nickel whatever dollar they can out of the combat sports fan.
Exactly, man. And it's just at the end of the day, people spend a lot of money on a lot of stuff. People got their Disney Plus subscription. People got their ESPN Plus subscription. They're paying a little money to watch Bellator on DAZN. And at the end of the day, they're going to look at this Combate America's card. They're going to be like, I can't justify spending this much money on this card. I can't justify spending this much money on one fight that's not even that good. That's kind of a joke. I only want to watch it because both these two people are famous and past their prime. So, yeah, this card sucks. You know, and it's no disrespect to the fighters on it. They're talented guys. It's just a matter of when you look at what we're expected to pay for in terms of like UFC level pay-per-views, as well as Bellator main cards on DAZN, usually it's just not up to snuff. You have a lot of solid fighters on the main card making their way in the scene. And you mentioned there's a couple guys we've seen. But again, the card itself doesn't excite me and entice me to spend money. I mean, if you're a wrestling fan, there's one former female wrestler, or she still wrestles sometimes, called Sexy Star. Her name's Dulce Garcia. She's somewhat interesting to watch if you're a wrestling fan, specifically like Lucha Libre. She was in the Lucha Libre scene, but then I think she like put on a real armbar on one of her opponents and after the match, and like wouldn't stop going after the match. And so she got blackballed in the sport of pro wrestling because she injured her opponent. Mm-hmm. So from that point forward, she went to actual shoot fighting. And so she's somewhat of a star in the Mexican audience. But again, whether you call him Alberto Del Rio or Alberto El Patron or Alberto Rodriguez, at the end of the day, this guy hasn't fought in a very long time. And when he did fight, his 9 victories weren't over anyone particularly impressive. So you got to think that this fight, in all likelihood, it's just hard to justify spending money on it, because there's the scary reality that you're going to spend money on it and the main event you're going to watch inside the cage is going to end up being like a farce.
Yeah, I mean, the other reality is, I mean, look, you know, the following Saturday, you're going to spend, you know, $60 for UFC 245. I mean, and you're talking, this pay-per-view is half the cost. I mean, you know, and as I always say, I want to see all mixed martial arts promotions succeed, because at the end of the day, that's going to be what is best for fighters and for fighters to succeed financially. And you want to see this return. I don't know what success will be, you know, for Combat Days. You know, I mean, look, Cale McLaren, he's has his way of promoting his product. I think that it probably does turn off, you know, some people, but, you know, we'll see what happens there. But yeah, to me, this is also like, I feel like at some point Sunday, I'm going to scroll through my Facebook or Twitter timeline and magically that full fight video is going to be there.
I mean, as soon as it happens Saturday night, it'll be there. Especially, oh, the full fight video? Well, the full fight video might be as long as the highlight video. So you might be lucky. I mean, I expect this one to be quick, because I expect, generally, when you have a guy who's at just a different level in this sport, this thing goes by quickly. It's a takedown, and it's a submission, and it's a 1-2-3. I mean, if Tito Ortiz doesn't demolish Alberto Del Rio, that's basically a loss. Again, for Alberto Del Rio, he just doesn't have the – he ain't Brock Lesnar. So he's not going to, I don't think, hop in the groove of things and be a halfway decent MMA fighter overnight. And I think against a guy who has a long-term history of training the sport, being really successful, Tito Ortiz not only has to beat Alberto El Patron, he's got to demolish him and embarrass him in order to for his own sake, for his own reputation, because a close fight or a boring fight or a long fight against Alberto Rodriguez, that is a failure for a former UFC champion.
Like, to me, for Alberto, there's not really he's not really in a lose-lose, you know, because, I mean, what, he's going to give Tito one of his WWE belts? I'm sure he's got multiple of those belts. I'm sure it's not like it's only WWE belt. You know, for Tito, I feel like it's like, man, what, I mean, obviously it's a payday. I don't know what Tito gains. And, you know, I thought of this yesterday, and I'm like, you know, one of the things of like my core principles in business and in my everyday life is, you know, what is the end game of what am I doing? You know, if I'm trying to accomplish something, what's my goal to get to? How do I, you know, see this playing out? And for Tito, I do wonder what is the end game for his, you know, MMA competitive career. At what point does he decide that, you know, the time is up for him? And that's, you know, and also, I mean, I know he's under a multi-fight deal with Combate, and I'm like, you know, after this, like, who is Combate going to put in there that is going to get you interested? I mean, I feel like, I mean, I understand that, you know, you're probably paying Tito and you're probably paying Alberto a ton of money for this fight. So that's probably why they pretty much probably had no choice but to put it, you know, on a pay scale, on a paywall, excuse me. But like, I sit there and say, like, I feel like they would have been better off like putting this on Univision.
Yeah, would have got a bigger audience. Big time. And I think they put this for free and people are going to have the curiosity factor enough to tune in. And to me, that's as much as this fight goes for me. It is the curiosity factor. It's not the type of fight that is going to attract a paying audience on pay-per-view, but it's definitely a type of fight where it's like a fight in a lunchroom where everyone's going to look if it's available to them. Everyone will probably take a gander when this fight's on the air if they have the ability to see it. Because, again, this fight is a freak show fight at this point in time. Mm-hmm. You know, Alberto Del Rio, he's getting this fight because he was a WWE champion, and that was a fake sport. Tito Ortiz is so past his prime. I mean, he was past his prime in like 2011. He had a late big time victory over Ryan Bader, and he had another victory in Bellator, which we're going to talk about later in our fight flashback. And he's had plenty. I mean, he has a pretty good record in Bellator, realistically, like 3-1. But for Tito, it's just not particularly impressive. We've seen him lose a lot. He's fought for a very long time. And honestly, he has battled a lot of injuries throughout his career. And that's why it's concerning that he's still fighting, is that you are concerned about his head and his quote unquote cracked skull, which I'm not super sure if that thing was ever cracked. but I just think for Tito, what's the long game, Jason? I think it's pretty simple. And I think it's actually the best case scenario for him in his old age. Because at the end of the day, this guy is really past his prime. He just doesn't have the explosiveness that he still has, which is like, duh, he's 44 years old. He's been competing in the sport since like there were dinosaurs inside the cage, your little baby dinosaurs. And so he should be so spent. I mean, it should be hard to get out of bed. That's the sacrifice you pay to be a mixed martial artist at the highest level for this long a time. So at this point in time, what does he want? A payday. That's what he wants. So for him, I'm happy for him because he can fight in Combate America, get a payday, and fight really bad fighters. And so that's perfect for him right now. If he beats Alberto Del Rio, who knows? Maybe he can call out the Undertaker next. To me, for Tito, it's all about the freak show fights. That, to me, is the only thing he has left in the tank. Because if you put him up against a top 10 light heavyweight, that fight probably shouldn't be regulated.
Now, before we kind of move on, there's one last thing I want to mention. I don't know if you have seen Campbell McLaren's tweet about his pound-for-pound list of fighters that are over 40. Have you seen this?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, God, you're going to. I'm going to read this 1 to 10. So here is a tweet. Some fighters over 40 are definitely still killers. My pound-for-pound list. Number 1, Tito Ortiz. Number 2, Daniel Cormier. Number 3, Alberto Rodriguez. Number 4, Uriah Faber. Number 5, Damian Maia. Number 6, Yoel Romero. Number 7, Fabricio Verdum. Number 8, Anderson Silva. 9, Chael Sonnen. 10, Andrei Arlovsky. Like, I don't, like, how do you take this serious?
You shouldn't take it serious. This is a madman. If you're putting Tito Ortiz over Daniel Cormier, you immediately all credit. Okay, yes.
Okay, that's bad. That's bad. Yeah. But Alberto Rodriguez at number 3?
He hasn't lost in 9 years, Jason. I mean,
he also hasn't competed.
That's an incredibly valid point. I'm just trying to figure out if I'm looking around the horn to see if we've missed anyone. If he missed anyone egregious, I don't know why I'm taking this list so seriously, but I'm scanning the UFC rankings currently just to see. I mean, did he even have Fedor on that list? Not that he should be on it
Fedor's not on the list. No.
What a disrespect to Fedor Emelianenko. To have Alberto Del Rio on this list and not Fedor, to have Del Rio third, Campbell McLaren. Look, man, if you want to – the circus is right there if you want to be a clown, but you're being a clown on Twitter.
I saw that the other day, and I'm like, oh, my God. I'm like, you know, I'll be interested to, you know, to see what the social media traffic is on Saturday for this one. But yeah, I'm not expecting good. But, you know, we did want to take a look back at, you know, this week's fight flashback. It is going to be Tito Ortiz versus Alexander Shevchenko. So this was from May 17th of 2014, took place at the Lander Center in South Haven, Mississippi, which was basically right outside of Memphis. I was at this event. And, you know, one of the things that one of my big memories from this event, I remember, I want to say the open workouts were on a Thursday, I want to say. And it was at a, you know, a MMA gym there in Memphis. And I remember we're interviewing Tito and Shevchenko walks in and you're just like, oh, my God. These dudes, like, it looks like we're having a welterweight against a light heavyweight here. Like, the size was so dramatic. You know, the other thing that, you know, really, you know, stuck out to me about that event was just how the crowd reacted to Tito. I remember, you know, sitting on press row just thinking, oh, my God, there is still a ton of people out here who want to see Tito Ortiz fight. And it kind of it had that sense of, okay, this is why Bellator signed Tito.
Yeah, man. Tito Ortiz, Chuck Liddell, all these fighters, man, people want to see them succeed. It's like, it's that nostalgia. And that's the sell with Tito Ortiz. Yeah. He really connected with like a whole crap load of people. I mean, we can't overstate how important Chuck Liddell, Tito Ortiz, and Randy Couture are to this sport today. They held this sport on their backs for a period. There was a period where they were the pay-per-view business in the UFC. And it was during a period where it was a transition of like people were really getting eager and invested into the UFC. And they were becoming lifelong fans. So it totally makes sense, man. It's very similar to in any entertainment industry where you keep on seeing these people trotted back out. So this fight was a very interesting pick because it was an absolute stunner what ended up happening here. I mean, you know, let's flash back to where Tito Ortiz was at this point. And Tito Ortiz was just coming off a run that still to this day paints my current perception on him. It was a bad run in the UFC. He only won one fight in about – he was 1-9, essentially. He had one draw against Rashad Evans. This is a span that spans 6 years, but he ended the UFC with three straight losses to Rashad Evans, Little Nogueira, and Forrest Griffin. This deal was the losses weren't particularly bad, but the fact that he was one after – and again, some of these fights were like the best fight on the card. But it was just a deal where we had seen Tito Ortiz for a very long time. He clearly was not the old the old Huntington Beach bad boy of old. And it just seemed like time had run out on him. And this was 2012. And so I believe he retired. Could be wrong. You know, he retired about 14 times. And then 2 years later, he gets the call for Bellator, gets the fight with Alexander Shevchenko. I mean, he was looking at best fight odds. He was like a over 200 favorite. I mean, excuse me, underdog against Shevchenko. I mean, when you were watching this fight, Jason, if you can remember, I mean, were you excited about this contest? And also kind of what did you think was going to happen?
I don't know if I would say I was excited. I mean, I think that there was the mindset I had was, okay, is Shevchenko just going to clip him? You know, but, you know, or is this just going to be what it ultimately turned into of where, you know, Tito just took him down. And I mean, Shevchenko just, he had no answer on the ground. I mean, like that is what I remember about the fight. And, you know, and when he wins the fight and, you know, he does the grave digger, you know, that what you're so used to of Tito, the atmosphere in the arena just, I mean, it was, you know, massive. I mean, of course, you know, something to remember about this event, this was originally going to be the rematch between Eddie Alvarez and Michael Chandler. Of course, Eddie gets hurt and then Will Brooks steps in and then, you know, they have a very close decision that goes Will Brooks's way. Ended up being Rampage and King Mo as the main event. But I just remember just, you know, and Shevchenko, you know, landed some good strikes early on in the fight. But, you know, Tito just, he was, once he got to the ground, it was game, set, match.
Well, yeah, but that's just because Tito Ortiz and Alexander Slamenko had the whole finish worked out. Remember that controversy?
Oh, God, yeah.
When people thought that the fix was in with this fight.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. I mean, and I remember having some tremendous controversies, you know. I've told this story before, but maybe someone hasn't heard us before. So that night after it was over, so like the press conference had ended, and we had just finished doing a scrum with Bjorn. And, you know, Bjorn looks at me and he goes, you know, what'd you think about the card? And I said, you know, it was okay. I go, man, it really dragged though. And basically Bjorn goes, you can go after yourself, you know, in a joking way. It wasn't anything in a serious way, but you know, that's why I remember kind of the car dragged on. I mean, but you know, I mean, it's just, it's a memorable night for Tito. And I don't know if Shalmenko's really been the same since.
Dude, that was my other thought. And it's not like, and it's all about perception in this sport. It really is. Because like you begin to look at his resume afterwards, it's a whole lot of victories, especially over halfway decent opponents. Excuse me. You know, he has Windsor, Yachislav Vasilevsky, Candle Grove, Paul Bradley, Brandon Halsey, and Yusubi Inamoto. He has wins over them afterwards. But for Alexander Slamenko, heading into the Tito Ortiz fight, I mean, this dude was the middleweight champion of Bellator. Every time we'd seen him in Bellator, he'd been damn right impressive with spinning strikes and whatnot, plenty of finishes, and he looked like a really top-tier middleweight. In this sport, sometimes we compare it to boxing where we say things like losses aren't that big of a deal, and they really aren't, but sometimes they are. And it feels like this specific loss to Tito Ortiz affected Shlemenko's perception in a major way. He was never the same guy. He was never perceived to be the same guy. His next fight right after that was against Brandon Halsey, and Halsey went out there and choked him out too. And that was the dagger in the heart for Shlemenko in terms of the perception. I mean, basically every other time we've seen him back in Bellator, he's lost except for two performances. One was a knockout win over Melvin Manhoff that was overturned because Shlemenko tested for steroids. And then he beat Kendall Grove. After this fight, though, it dramatically affected his stock, and it does remind you what's on the line. Whenever you see these major upsets in the sport, you got to understand that the person who just got upset just lost a whole lot of money, and that was the case for Shlemenko.
Yeah, I mean, actually, I was just looking. Shlemenko actually has a fight book next week against Lewis Taylor. You know, he's coming off a loss against Chris Honeycutt, who no longer in Bellator. You know, so it was kind of, you know, that was one of those interesting kind of moves that Bellator, you know, didn't bring him back. But yeah, it was a memorable night for me just because I was there and kind of just seeing how the crowd reacted. And I kind of feel like that's probably going to be probably a similar reaction on Saturday night in Hidalgo of Tito. You know, the only thing I really hate the whole mixing politics and sports. And obviously, I think anyone, you know, you know, it'll be interesting to see if that narrative continues, or does there become a point where someone gets to Tito and go, hey, we don't need to mix politics into this.
Yeah. I think Combate Americas won't have that foresight. And I'm sure they probably don't mind it, and it's probably a shame. Not a fan of politics and sports either. It's just not fun. I mean, politics, especially, it's an important point to make, especially in 2019, because the thing is, politics is just more present on human beings' minds than ever before. Mm-hmm, because yeah. When you go on Twitter and on Facebook, it's just all mixed together. It's just, oh, here's grandma's latest cooking dish, and then here's 15 reasons why this politician is a dirtbag. And it's just, we see it all the time, whereas in 2005, you could really separate these things. You could not know what's going on in Capitol Hill and just live your life. That is impossible now. So on top of just constantly being force-fed it, and a lot of times, man, it don't taste too good, to have it introduced into your sports, I'm a bit tired of it. Tito Ortiz, I think, will get cheered. But if he comes out like Make America Great Again paraphernalia in this Pacific area, he will get booed. I mean, yeah, there's plenty of conservatives here, especially older people in the community. But for the most part, a massively Hispanic crowd, very liberal. So yeah, Tito Ortiz, like, I mean, dude, you probably would have got cheered. People are going to cheer him though, because this guy's a star, and we're just going to kind of be in awe of him. He's a former UFC champion, and that is a big deal for him to be competing down here.
I mean, look, he got on Fox News this week, which I think that's a really big deal. Obviously, it's because of his support of the president, which, you know, I think you turn to a UFC angle of this, it makes you wonder, could Colby Covington, you know, be on Fox News next week, and does that relate to pay-per-view buys or not? But we'll see what happens there. But of course, that goes down on Saturday night. But Daniel, over the last 6 days or so, it's been a bunch of UFC fight bookings for the first quarter of 2020, and it was on Thanksgiving it gets announced. It's done. It's ready to go. Conor McGregor versus Donald Cerrone at UFC 246 on January the 18th. I actually saw there was some negative feedback for this fight. I'm like, I'm sitting here and I didn't quite understand that. I think this is the right fight to make. I think the only thing that jumped out to you is the fact that it's at 170 pounds, which I can take that one of two ways, Dan. You know, one way is the fact of, hey, you know what? Let's just have these guys fighting at a healthy weight where they're not really cutting weight. But then my other side, I think this is more probably the realistic side of this. Is this the UFC's way of setting up Conor McGregor versus Jorge Masvidal?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that's a big way too. And you know what? Cerrone versus Masvidal wouldn't be too bad either. I think Cerrone versus Masvidal would absolutely be worthy of the BMF title. That's all I got to say about that. But I mean, it's all about Conor when Conor fights. It's all about what are you setting them up to do next. And this fight makes all the sense in the world, man. Hopefully the UFC, for them, for their sake, they don't regret putting Conor McGregor on pay-per-view. I mean, this is something we've talked about a while, and you've really been hitting this one, is should the UFC be in the Conor McGregor business because of all the things that have happened with him outside of the cage?
I feel like they just don't care, Daniel.
Mm-hmm. No, they don't.
I think it's about, we need big money fights. It'll be interesting is during fight week, how much media availability is there with Conor McGregor? How much media availability is there with Dana White? Look, and when I talk about media availability, I'm not talking about ESPN, because let's be honest about it, that's an extension of the UFC's PR department. You know, just being honest about it, you're not going to get hard hitting journalism coming from ESPN with the amount of money they're paying the UFC, you know, every year. Is will there be a reporter that will bring up, you know, the New York Times reports, you know, and not just to Conor McGregor, but also to Dana White? I mean, it's just, you know, I feel like it's, you know, it's just, I think my thing is, I just want to hear words come out of Conor McGregor's mouth about it. It's great to hear his manager say something or his PR person say something, but I want to hear words come out of Conor McGregor's mouth about these reports by the New York Times.
Yeah, like straight up, bro. If you're going to sexually assault someone, which again, this is an investigation and allegations, so it's not like that. If you're going to sexually assault someone, there should be consequences, and we shouldn't just sweep it under the rug. I mean, that's some crazy. That's unbelievably evil and incredibly messed up. And if you, it's like, damn, it's like, yo, you're privileged because you're this high level athlete in the world. You can just break the rules of the world. You can just ruin experiences for people and commit a crime against someone. I mean, it's really upsetting that there aren't checks and balances and people aren't necessarily held accountable. You can't just go and do a 45 minute interview or repeat the same three sentences about your apology, man. I mean, It's messed up. It kind of sucks because you're like, well, life's supposed to be fair. You can't just skirt by just by being, you know, rich and famous. But Conor has, and the UFC's enabled it. And unfortunately, I mean, kind of, you know, so have I. I'm like excited about this fight. I'm going to get excited about this fight. I'm going to watch it. I'm going to spend money on it, which is a bit of a shame because I do think just generally as a society, we should absolutely – if we have people who do sexual assault, and again, it's an investigation and allegation, We should definitely be like, hey, man, you don't get to be a part of our little entertainment circle. Like, you can go work somewhere else, you know, but not somewhere where we romanticize you, idolize you, hold you up, and give you a whole lot of money. So that's my kind of general moral quandary I feel in my heart of hearts. The one thing that will help me sleep well at night is I'm happy for Donald Cerrone that he got this fight. I mean, this is a guy who has given the fans like so many amazing contests. This is, he's at a point where he's lost two in a row to two of the best guys in lightweight division. And so there's a good chance he would not have gotten this fight, but he has an opportunity to make a whole lot of money right now with this fight. And I'm very, very, very happy for Donald Cerrone that he gets his opportunity, because this will be a huge fight. And I hope he gets that one big payday, and I hope for the first time in his career he saves some money after it.
I mean, it should be a fun fight to watch. I think we can both agree with that. You know, I think in terms of, you know, kind of breaking down the fight, I think what'll be interesting to see is I really believe that Donald's got to play this fight in the clinch and maybe, you know, try to get this fight to the ground to work his jiu-jitsu, because, I mean, Cowboy is very, I mean, he's very skilled when it comes to jiu-jitsu. You know, if this fight's at range, Conor McGregor's going to pick him apart. And when you do look at a lot of Cowboy's losses, they are against southpaws. And, you know, I think this fight makes all the sense in the world. It's a, you know, I think what you say, you know, you like Conor's chances in this fight. And, you know, Conor says he wants to fight, you know, three times in 2020. And, you know, does that lead, you know, you have to imagine that second fight would be against Jorge Masvidal, you know. And I think that, you know, you kind of, you know, I look at Conor and I think, you know, you kind of look at Jorge in this slide too, is I just feel like there are stages of their career where being a UFC champion, I don't think is kind of, you know, the top of their priority list. So I like that fight. I mean, look, I'll clearly be, you know, buying that pay-per-view. You know, of course, last week we talked about UFC 247, Jones versus Reyes. Apparently, UFC 248, there's going to be at least one title fight. Zhang Weili, you know, defending her title against Joanna Jędrzejczyk. There is a rumor out there that potentially that card could also see Israel Adesanya defending his middleweight title against Yoel Romero. And then UFC 149, April 18th, Khabib Ferguson, it is set. And, you know, look, I'm excited for this fight, but like, Daniel, it's like you said last week on the podcast, we can't get excited for this fight until April the 18th at 9:59 p.m.
Exactly, man. Exactly. We have seen this story time and again. And yeah, it's
like I saw all these people on social media get all excited when the fight was made official. I'm like, do you guys forget we've been down this road four different times? Like it's one of these fights. Like, I'm like, I go, we can't talk about this fight. The MMA gods will ruin it for us.
Absolutely. We cannot, we cannot talk about this fight until it happens. That's all. I totally agree with you. And,
but when you look at those four fights that I mentioned, clearly Tony Khabib is a fight that interests you the most.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. To me, if you're ranking it, it's pretty easy ranking. I think if anyone disagrees, they're nuts. Khabib, Tony, Conor, Cerrone, Jones and Reyes, and then Zhang and Joanna. I guess you could switch those last two depending on how you feel about that fight. I think that's a good little fight. To me, the most interesting thing about UFC 248 is where that fight takes place. I think it will probably be an international country.
I don't think they've said where it's going to be.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's a TBD. So I think it would be interesting if they place that pay-per-view in another country. But man, I tell you, it's tough to place a pay-per-view in another country though. But,
I mean, it would make sense to put that fight in China.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. In China, or yeah, China would be great. Cause this might be the last time they have a Chinese champion in a while. If she loses to Joanna, I mean, well, what Weili Zhang has accomplished is like, holy moly, that's one hell of an accomplishment. But again, it's hard to hold that strap in Joanna. I mean, she's been hungry to regain it. And this is a great opportunity for her. I mean, yeah. All these favorite fights I'm looking forward to, man. I really am. I think 2020 is going to end up being a really good year for mixed martial arts. I think usually every year we start off kind of optimistic about how it's going to be a good year. And then in the middle of the year, we're like, it's hellfire and brimstone. Every fight is canceled. And Tito Ortiz is the number one ranked fighter in the world. But I'm looking forward to these fights, man. I think they got some good main events going on.
Yeah, I mean, and that's all we can ask for as fight consumers is that you give us reasons to, you know, put over our $60. And, you know, right now, and hopefully all these fights stay together, it should be a great opening quarter for the UFC. But, you know, of course, coming up next week is UFC.
I just want to point out one thing. Jesus Christ. The freaking last time these two guys were supposed to fight was the same arena in Barclays Center in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
And we're putting them there? Dude, does the UFC not know a single thing about, like, jinxes and luck before making this match? They go under a ladder. Oh, my God. Yeah. Sorry. I was doing some Googling because I just – when I saw Barclays Center next to the name of these two fighters, I'm like, this fight should not be happening here. I don't know why. And now I just figured it out. It was UFC 223 and they were supposed to fight and Al Heyman just stepped in. So yeah. Sorry for interrupting. I just had to mention that.
Yeah, it's this fight's been booked a couple of times. Hopefully it happens in April. But of course next week is UFC 245 and one of the men that's gonna be on that card is Ben Saunders. I had a chance to catch up with him yesterday, so you're gonna hear my conversation with him as we talked about a wide range of topics. Then you're gonna hear my conversation with manager/coach Tyson Chardy, represents Rob Font, also works with several other fighters there in the Northeast. So got some updates on some fighters there in the Northeast. Also talked about his experience being in Russia, with Calvin Kattar. Of course, Calvin's one of his clients, also coaches Calvin. So here's my conversations with Ben Saunders and Tyson Chardier. Joining me now here on the MMA Report as a man steps back inside the UFC Octagon. UFC 245 takes on Matt Brown. It's Ben Saunders. Ben, man, I appreciate time. You know, we talked back in June, and obviously we talked about, you know, the move to Vegas and everything. And, you know, I saw your Instagram post where you talked about working with Kyle there at the PI, and kind of made me think of the conversation I had with Cody Stamann about a week ago where, you know, he moved out there, and the PI was a big reason why he moved out there. And he said, he goes, at the PI, it's just they keep you accountable. Is that kind of a good way that you kind of sum up with your experience there?
I also feel that they have a lot of, I mean, man, just tons of knowledge in the fight game and how to not only prepare for fights, correct strength and conditioning, rehabilitation, all that, but they actually work hand in hand with all the coaches too that I have out here. So you don't really see that. You definitely don't really see that quite often. So to see everybody be able to work together as one unit really makes it super easy for me as the fighter or the athlete to kind of put everything together and believe everything's going according to plan.
You know, one of the things Cody mentioned to me, he's like, it's just not combat sports people that are in the PI. He says you'll see basketball players roll through, whatnot. When you see someone from another sport roll through it and you see how they're going through their workout, do you try to maybe take some things that they're doing and incorporate it into how you prepare for a fight?
I wouldn't say that I do. I definitely see some people see some of the stuff that I do and they look over and they seem either confused or intrigued. Whether or not they take it and they use it, I don't know. I think between what I do and what the UFC PI and my actual strength and conditioning coach and everybody recommends, I'm always open, but I have to kind of feel it out and see like how my body is going to react to whatever this new training process or exercise may be.
Do you see a difference in your body right now as opposed to your last fight?
Actually, I do. It's actually been a long time since I've had a proper training camp, correct time, correct strength and conditioning, great quality rehabilitation. I think three of my last four fights have been 4 weeks notice or less, one of them being 2 weeks notice. Man, I mean, that's partly due to the fact that I just like to fight. It's also due to the fact that at the time I was really managing myself. And I'm probably not the best manager for myself because I really am that guy that if an opportunity shows up and I'm healthy enough to fight, my mentality is I could get hit by a car, or I could have an injury or accident that pulls me out or has me never fight again. So if I'm capable of doing it, I'm all in. I want to jump in. I love fighting, and I love the experience that I gain no matter the outcome that occurs. And since day one, it's always been win, lose, or draw. You know you're going to get a fight. But I personally feel that – hold on. Phone call. I got to say that really taking the smart approach and giving myself the correct time to build a good strength and conditioning regimen, to build my body and fix my body to be in peak fight shape, is probably not only the healthiest for me as an athlete, but it seems to be what I should be doing for my family, my friends, and all the fans out there, because everybody wants to see me that's on my side, wants to see me do well. But all the fans that just want to see a good fight, they want to see guys fight to the best of their abilities. And when you're going in a little bit underprepared, it's unfortunate, because especially the way I fight and the style that I bring to the cage, I feel having it all in order is going to give the fans and everybody, the promotions, everything, what they really want when they hire me for a fight.
You know, I think when we think about this fight coming up here, you know, next weekend in Vegas, it's I think every fan's like, oh man, this is gonna be an action-packed fight. Matt's going to bring it. You're going to bring it. Yes. Is that kind of like what gets you excited about the fight? It's like, look, I know Matt's going to bring it to me. You know, we're going to meet in the middle of the cage, and man, this is going to be a war. Is that what gets you excited?
Oh, super excited. I mean, again, on top of the fact that I haven't really had a lot of preparation times in my past fights to really get amped up and excited, this is the first fighter and the first name that I've gotten quite some time that's had me just super amped and super motivated every time I go to the gym and had to push through those 2-a-days and really, even if I'm not feeling it, you know, the motivation comes in because I know the fight that I'm getting and the opportunity is just that important and that exciting to all the fans out there.
You know, I haven't looked at the betting odds, but I think most likely, you know, everyone's going to consider you the underdog in the fight. Do you like that?
Doesn't matter to me. I mean, I feel bad for everybody that, you know, bets and then ends up losing money. But, you know, it seems like when I'm the underdog, and I win, I make people good money because of those betting odds. I also tend to piss off a lot of people because I feel most people probably bet against the underdog. You know, they go with the favorite,
yeah,
and the most, I guess, on the judging or the betting lines, the more practical way to get that win, even if it's not by a huge margin as far as making money for what you put down. But I don't bet too much, man. I got friends that do it. You know, gambling for me, I'm just like, dude, I gamble every day that I train. I gamble every day that I fight. So I work so hard for my money. I'm not really interested in throwing it away on somebody else's situation that could go either way. If I was going to gamble, it'd be everything on me though.
I just actually looked up the betting lines. You're a 3-1 underdog.
Everything down on me then.
with you living in Vegas, I'm sure you know, it was Saturday, you know, maybe you and your friends rolled a casino. You see the lines on a fight. Do sometimes you sit there as a fighter who you see this game totally different than 90% of the people that are watching a fight? Do you sit there and look at that board of the odds and just go, is there something I'm missing?
Honestly, because I'm so involved in the sport and I feel knowledgeable in the sport, I think betting in this game is very, very sketchy because really on any given night, there's so many factors and so many ways that things can kind of happen. That even if you think that this guy's got all the skill set and, you know, is a world beater or championship level skill set, maybe they had a shitty cut, you know? Mm-hmm. Maybe they have a lot of personal things going on in their personal life that we don't know about. You know, maybe they got injured in the training camp. It takes something as stupid as rolling your ankle and now you can't run or be mobile. And then you have a shitty weight cut and a shitty camp and then a shitty performance. So really, there's so many factors that kind of go into it and so many ways that the fight can play out that I really, again, that's why I don't bet. But I think those that do bet are always going to be taking a big gamble because there's no guarantees. There are things like, oh, John Jones versus who? Yeah, you probably are going to be in a good spot if you put some money down on John Jones. But again, the amount, to my knowledge, because I don't bet much, but if he's a very high favorite, you have to put so much money down to actually make even a little bit of money that it's like, well, then you have to take a big gamble too there. Or you're just kind of like doing it for the fun of the bet and to make it more enjoyable and not really so much of, oh, if I lose this $20 or $100, I'm screwed. As opposed to, what, you throw $100 down on John Jones, is like, you might make $20 from that, you know?
Maybe,
and if you lose, you're losing all of it, right? But if you're like, oh, I'm going to go all in, I'm going to put $10,000 down so I can make a little bit, you know, hopefully $2,000 from the $10,000 bet, and then something goes wrong, oh, man, that's $10,000 you just lost, son, like that?
Yeah. Crazy. Yeah. Because one punch, one kick, and it totally changed everything. In terms of your fight with Matt, one of the things that, you know, does stick out to you is, hey, it's been 2 years since we've seen Matt. He's a vet in this sport, and you know the cliche that you always hear is, look, you know what? I know what's coming. I know what to expect. But is there also that part of you that sits there and says, you know what? I'm going to expect there's going to be some new tricks I got to be looking out for.
You're saying for him coming from the layoff, it can definitely play a role. Because even if you are extremely experienced, man, dude, I know for a fact that I've been fighting almost 16 years and I've never taken 2 years off. You know, I'm one of the most active fighters I feel in the game. So, I think that definitely could play a role, but it could also be just fantastic as far as maybe you're burnt out. Maybe you needed a break, you know, maybe that recovery time and that time away just helped you kind of get more motivated. Maybe you burn out, you know, there's definitely a lot of factors where it could work in your favor, work against you. I'm going to go into the assumption of, oh damn, he had 2 years off to get absolutely prepared for this comeback. He's going to be in the best shape and the best health possible leading into this. It's going to be the best Matt Brown I've ever seen. And that's the one, as a samurai, that's what I look for. I want my opponent that I fight dead on to be the best opponent they could ever possibly be. So when I beat them, I beat the best of them. Mm-hmm. No strings attached, no excuses, no unfortunate factors that might play additional roles in the outcome. I want me to be 100%. I want them to be 100%. So when we do battle, they see 200% guys going at it, and may the victor be the greater man that night.
What do you think your key to victory is?
Ooh, a lot. Man, I got it everywhere. I know he does too, man, but there's no one in the game like me. Even if you find someone that's as tall and as lanky as me, for them to have the skill set that I bring to the table, I can beat you on the feet. I can submit you on the feet. I can beat you on the ground. I can TKO you and ground and pound you. I can submit you on the ground. I'm honestly looking to create a highlight reel and, if possible, showcase some techniques and some, I guess, violence that's never been seen before inside that octagon. I'm looking to steal the show with my fight against Matt Brown.
One thing I got to mention, when I was on your Instagram, I think you're just kind of like a lot of the MMA community, very excited for Khabib and Ferguson. And you mentioned this game is, you can't predict things. You gamble, you're taking a chance. From your perspective, I mean, obviously, just because this fight's been booked so many times, I think all of us are like, just put these guys in bubble wrap. Just, you know, let them walk into the cage. Let's not even weigh them in, weigh whatever, just let them get in the cage. But for you, from your excitement level to see that fight, is there just a certain aspect of just because these are the two best 55ers that you just kind of want to see, how does Khabib's wrestling go up against Tony's jiu-jitsu game?
For me, it's a combination of stylistic matchup. I think it's such a fantastic stylistic matchup that's very intriguing for anybody that's really involved in the sport and knows what's going on. The other thing would be that I flew out for the last Khabib versus Tony fight here in Vegas, where I think he had to go to the, that was the one he had to go to the hospital for, and they called it off. And that really pissed me off because, I mean, it is what it is. It didn't piss me off like I took it personal, but it just sucks to I last minute made the plans and I was like, wait a minute, this is going to be possibly the first 10th planet UFC champion. I'm there. So I flew out, met up with Eddie Bravo, you know, got a hotel and everything out there for it, was there for a couple of days. Luckily, I was able to turn the trip into going to Los Angeles to train with Eddie for a couple of weeks afterwards. So it wasn't like a complete loss. I was already all the way on the West Coast, so I was able to make the best of it. But that's what I came out there for. And then we kind of got that not so great main event.
Yeah, it's a bummer. I mean, obviously everyone knows for you with 10th Planet, of course, Tony being there as well. When we think of Tony and his jiu-jitsu, Darce choke is something that immediately jumps out. And I've heard other fighters talk about it. They say it's not just one thing he does. He does in various ways. From your perspective, like, is there times that you watch Tony on the ground when he's going for Darce and going, man, how is he pulling all these moves off?
Definitely not wondering why. Though I'm quite often being like, brilliant. That's beautiful. Like, knowing what's going on, knowing the system or knowing jiu-jitsu pretty damn well, and just seeing the transitions that he makes. But he did he's one of the fantastic wrestlers that dove into jiu-jitsu as well. And if there's one thing wrestlers are fantastic at, it's headlocks and just head control in general. So going from that and him being so lanky and long with his arms, I mean, anacondas, chin straps, and all that is completely there and available for him. So to see him be able to use it very well for his body type is just fantastic to watch.
Of course, we look forward to seeing that fight. Of course, we look forward to seeing your fight next Saturday night, UFC 245, of course, in Las Vegas. Ben, as always, man, I really appreciate time. Of course, let me know anything for you on social media. If anybody else you want to shout out, man.
Anybody that wants to follow me on social media, at Ben Saunders MMA is my screen name for everything. I would say thank you to Garden of Life. Thank you to Thorn. Thank you to Fuji, one of the best clothing companies in the world. And I look forward to you guys being able to either come out for the fight or order the pay-per-view, or if it's on free TV, just make sure to stay tuned because you're not going to want to miss it.
Joining me now here on the MMA Report is a man that had opportunity to talk to so many times. Great to have him back on the show, the man who runs Top Game Management. along with manager, also coach Tyson Chartier. Tyson, appreciate time. Last week on the show, I had Ricky Simone, so I reached out to Ed. I go, hey, let's get Tyson on the show to kind of talk about the Rob aspect of this. And I was watching their interview you did. Rob was your first client?
Mm-hmm. Well, he was my first client to get to the UFC. So my first client was one of Rob's teammates, Louis Crappie.
Okay.
And then, so I got him a fight on the same card that I got Rico DeShulo. He fought on the Contender Series against Montel Jackson a couple of years ago. So those are my first two clients. But then the next card that I had guys fight on, Rob was an amateur on that card. So he was like right there with the first handful of guys that I managed.
I remember it was, I want to say it was like back in about February. I interview Ricky. He mentions Rob. I shoot you a text. I go, hey, Simone's interested in Rob fight. You're like, hey, we like that matchup too. But it's been a weird year for Rob. Obviously, with what happened in June and just kind of, it's been a funky year for him. I mean, is that kind of like, is it one of those things of just inside the team? It's like, man, thank God we finally got a fight.
I mean, let's not say we got it until it happens. And at this point with Rob, he's, you know, he had, you know, Stamen pull out 2 weeks before the fight and then Lineker pull out 10 hours before the weigh-ins. And then we don't get a fight. And then it was going to be a quick turnaround. Then it didn't happen. Then it was 100% Boston. It didn't happen. And now supposedly it's Saturday against Ricky Simone. So let's hope there's no curveballs. You know, because Rob's had another situation where, you know, half hour before weigh-ins in London, Ian Whistle pulled out. So this is something that he's had to deal with a little bit more than others in his career. So it's definitely been a rough year. In the prime of your career, being a healthy scratch when you're ranked in the top 10, it's a tough pill to swallow. But I think it's if there's one thing I'll say about Rob is that there was no sour grapes. Obviously he's frustrated, but you're going to see when he steps in the cage, he's better than he was against Sergio Pettis. And I think a lot of fighters, when they get frustrated, they go on vacation, they do this, they skip sessions, they may, you know, have a couple beers. Rob just stayed in the gym. Like, he was basically in fight camp the whole summer because we thought we were fighting. He just keeps improving, keeps getting better. So, I mean, I think he, you know, kind of goes by our mantra, which is like, focus on what you can control. And the only thing we can control is getting in the gym and getting better. And now hopefully Saturday night, he'll get to show that.
You know, one of the things I see, you use a hashtag. I see Rob use a hashtag. So what is like the origin of the New England cartel?
So we never really had a teammate. We all train, you know, a lot of the best guys in New England go to Lauzon MMA and train. And we spar there, and that's like our team, obviously. But Rob trains at like six other gyms too. And so he never wanted to say like just 100% out of Lauzon MMA, not because he doesn't want to represent them, because he does, you know, they've cornered him his last couple fights. But he didn't want to like upset other people. So he just all of a sudden, I think it was before the last fight, he started just saying New England cartel. And if you look up the definition of a cartel, it's like everybody kind of coming together with a common goal to, I know this is the drug version of it, but basically kind of, yeah, embodies what we're trying to do, which is like a bunch of people coming together for a common goal. And that's really what it is, you know, New England, some of the best coaches, some of the best training partners, some of the best gyms, you know, opening up their doors and allowing him to come in and get the best work. And I think it's mutually beneficial because, you know, he goes in there and works with some of those coaches, but he gets to work with some of those young fighters and then they get to work with him. So it's a definitely a give and take. And so I think he just kind of ran with it. Now he's kind of branding it as, you know, the New England cartel. It's pretty cool though. You know, I mean, I don't want to offend anybody by saying cartel, because I know there's some people like, hey, be careful with cartel. It's like, yeah, we're not a real cartel, but it's cool. Cause it's just giving him something to like talk about, you know, him, Calvin, me, a bunch of the other guys in New England, they're starting to kind of jump on board and, you know, give us something. It's almost like a rally cry. So it's good. And hopefully moving forward, we can, you know, brand it a little better. So, you know, selling some swag and stuff like that. And, you know, just get the name out there more.
You know, when I talked to Ricky about the fight, you know, one of the things we talked about is, you know, you think of Rob, you think of striking. And one of the things Ricky pointed out, he said, look, he goes, everyone wants to talk about Rob striking. He goes, his jiu-jitsu is really good. He goes, it's just no one, you know, it's just not his go-to thing. Is there something about Ricky's game that kind of sticks out that just like people just don't think of Ricky in that way?
No, I think the thing that makes Ricky dangerous is the fact that, like, I think he knows that Rob's a better striker. And I think he knows that Rob's also dangerous on the ground. So, like, when guys are in that position where they're kind of like, hey, I just got to go and fight. You know, those guys tend to be a little bit unpredictable. They're going to throw big bombs. They're going to, like, they're going to let the hands go. So you got to kind of, you got to be ready for the unexpected. They're going to try crazy stuff. They're going to be a little bit more unorthodox. It's not going to be a meat and potatoes. Let's sit behind my jab and set up my takedown, because he knows it's probably not going to work. So you got to be ready for anything. Expect the unexpected. When guys are smart enough to know what their disadvantages are in a fight, it almost makes them a little bit more dangerous. So, you know, we're prepared for that, but I think, you know, Ricky brings a certain skill set. You know, if crap hits the fan in this fight, you know he's going to shoot. Rob's extremely hard to take down if he knows that that's what you're trying to do. You know, he can get caught with some surprise takedowns like he did with Sun Tzu and stuff. But, you know, Rob's – I mean, I just don't see how Ricky's going to be able to take him down. And if he does take him down, Ricky hasn't really shown the ability to hold people down. You know, it's kind of – if you look at the Montel Jackson fight, Montel's a great wrestler, and Ricky really did, like, perform in that fight, which is – that's the fight that got him ranked. He was able to take Montel down, but he couldn't hold him down. You know, it was just over and over, kind of just holding him down. It wasn't the most exciting fight, but, you know, he did what it took to win. I just don't see him being able to do that with Rob. Rob's a lot more dangerous when people try to close distance on him. He's got a little bit more weapons. I don't think Montel was at the experience level yet where he was able to handle that pressure. You know, I think obviously we'll see Saturday night.
I mean, the fact that he's just coming off a knockout the way he, you know, losing against Faber, I mean, Do you and the team even, like, put that in consideration of, you know, could he be tentative or anything along those lines? Or is that just something that we think of as people who commentate on the sport that, you know, we might see a little bit of a different Ricky?
Yeah, you might see someone a little bit gun-shy, or you might see him a little bit more aggressive. Like, I think it goes two ways. Like, you know, you see people come off losses and they're like, I just got to let it go next time. Or you see people come off losses, I got to be careful, I got to work on my defense. So you don't necessarily know which approach he's going to come in with. That, you know, revert back to what I originally said, like, we got to expect the unexpected in this fight. And it just comes back to basics. You know, Rob's got to have his feet under him, stay long, use his length. And, you know, we can't hunt for the knockout. We just got to touch him and the knockout's going to come.
Of course, you know, obviously you manage multiple fighters up there in the Northeast. I know you were just in Moscow, obviously, with Calvin Kattar. You know, obviously, unfortunately, that one did go, you know, I said I think that fight goes five rounds. I think it's a little bit of a different story. But what was the experience like for you going over there and seeing what the MMA culture is like? I mean, obviously, we see all these shows that, you know, come from Russia, but your firsthand experience, what was your take of what the MMA scene is there?
It was pretty cool, like, I really thought we were going to go in and, like, need extra security type thing. Like, they were going to hate us so much, but it was kind of the opposite. Like, when we saw people on the street, they all wanted pictures, obviously not my picture. I was usually the one taking the picture. You know, they all wanted his picture. They wanted autographs, you know, all that stuff. But a lot of the general theme was like, kick his ass. Like, we don't like those guys. And I don't get involved in the politics, and I don't really understand the landscape of Russia versus Dagestan, but it was a lot of the same theme. It was like, no. We like you guys. We like you guys. We're cheering for you. And so I'm not saying that more people were cheering for Calvin than not, because clearly the Zabit chants in the crowd showed that, you know, they're mostly pro Zabit. But I think there was a lot more support for us than we had anticipated, which was cool. And there was no, like, I mean, they didn't start booze in the arena, so I think that probably contributed. But there was no, like, people throwing things at us or yelling, you know, mean things on the way in or the way out. It was like, it was just like going to Brazil. It was like, they'll boo you on the way in and cheer you on the way out. So I think they're, you know, that's a good market for the UFC, because you can tell they were like all about it. And those young kids, man, it was teenagers, and they were just super fans. So it was cool to see the, you know, it was a pretty hyped up open workout. So it was overall, it was a good week.
I don't know if you feel the same way, but I feel like, I mean, yeah, obviously you hate that you couldn't walk away with the victory there, but I feel like Calvin kind of cemented his place, you know, in the featherweight division, you know, where, you know, heading into the fight, it was like, okay, this is a big, noble fight for Calvin. But now it seems like the community is like, oh, Calvin, you know, he is a top 10 guy.
I think there's a few people that were saying, oh, Zabit's not the guy. That was like kind of the uneducated saying, like, oh, Zabit, he's not ready for a title fight. I think it was the opposite. And I think this is what the majority came away thinking, is like, okay, Calvin is the guy. Like, Calvin is one of those top contenders. I honestly thought, like, based on our performance, even though we felt like we underperformed, I thought based on how, I guess you say, well we did against him, I thought we'd jump a few people in the rankings, even with a loss, just because it kind of cemented, like you're saying, like, everybody realized, like, okay, Calvin's right there. you know? Whereas like all these other people that have gone against Zabit have gotten mauled. Like, you know, Jeremy Stephens had a good fight against him, but he did get mauled in one of those rounds. You know, talking mounted, stretched out on your belly, you know, put into some pretty bad positions. We were never in any sort of threat. I think if you score the fight as a whole, some people could argue we won, but we didn't win. You know, we just lost the rounds the way, you know, the rule set is. And I think he showed that he belongs right there. And I think the performance, even though it was a loss, it really did earn us like another good fight, like a loser of Ortega or Korean Zombie type fight. I don't think necessarily we have to go and fight Jeremy Stephens, who's ranked like 9 or 10 above us. I know I saw Emmett just got booked, but I think we're right there. Like, I don't think our stock went down. I think our stock went up. I think they realized like, okay, like we can market this kid. He's got a style that we like. And I think we answered some of the questions that people thought about, like maybe our defensive wrestling as well.
I mean, I know you're going to South Korea in December with Mike Rodriguez. I mean, are we doing a little scouting on the main event as well?
Hey, man, I'm going to watch that thing. Like, if we had won, I'd want to have him to be there weighing in just in case, you know. It'll be a good fight. It's, you know, I think it'll have title implications. I think if Korean Zombie wins, he probably gets the next title shot, in my opinion. If Ortega wins, I don't see him going right to a title shot after getting beat up like he did with Ortega last time. So we'll see. Like, I think it's got title implications, but it also got implications on maybe possibly who we fight next.
You know, Mike Rodriguez, obviously, you know, after what happened earlier this year, gets an opportunity. What's kind of the thought process with Mike heading in this one?
You know, just be as healthy as we can going into the fight and then, you know, erase your memory from that last one. You know, we went out there, opponent changed. We thought we were going to get a good name in Jean Valente, and then he pulled out with a couple weeks. We fight this new guy that came in. Unfortunately, he failed the test, and now it's a no contest. But, you know, Mike got beat up a little bit in that fight. He had trouble managing distance. He was kind of had some blurred vision, you know, but no excuses. Like, he just didn't win the fight. And so he's been in the gym since then. You know, he had some little dings that he nursed, and, you know, we get into this fight, and, you know, now in a few weeks, he's going to go out there and show everybody, like, you know, hopefully the same fighter that came out and won in Milwaukee a year ago.
Some of your other UFC clients, I know Jorgen Castro, it seems like he's on about social media every day, you know, seeking for a fight. It sounds like March is pretty much kind of the timeline he's looking at.
Yeah, we're looking at probably like February, March. Like, I, you know, text Mick a little bit about it. And, you know, we're not pushing for anything too soon. But, you know, he can get back in the gym. Like you said, he's only 5-6-0 now. There's no rush to like move him along super, super fast. I think, you know, for the UFC with him coming off a great win like he did, and coming off the contender series and not having, you know, a lot of fights, they have to figure out an opponent that makes sense, which obviously that's how you want to be handled, you know? So, if we can get in there in February, March, something domestic this time, those taxes in Australia kill you. So if, you can get another chance to get back in there and, and I have to pay 30% to Australia, that'd be nice.
Yeah, I was listening to an interview that James Krause did, and he was talking about why previously he did not want to go to Brazil. He's like, you get double tax. He goes, unless the UFC is gonna match that money, it doesn't make sense. I mean, is that kind of one of the things you have to have that conversation with client? Okay, hey, we can take this overseas fight, but just understand it's gonna cost you this amount of money in taxes.
You don't always get a say, you know what I mean? If the UFC calls you up and says, hey, do you want to fight someone that's 3-0 that you think, and then that we think is a good matchup, it's like I told Jorgen and his coaches before the fight, like, we're not taking this fight for the money. We're taking this fight to get a win. And that's all, like, on that first UFC contract, in my opinion, like, you have to take fights. Like, if they offer you a fight that you think is a good matchup, you jump on that. Even if it's in China, like, you got to get wins. And the whole goal is to get to that second contract and get a good negotiation. And that's where you can finally start like saving money. Cause those first few fights, you're not making a lot of money. You know, you fly your coaches out there, you invest money into a camp. It's not about getting rich that first contract. You know, second, third contract is where you can really start like changing your life. And, you know, that's kind of the attitude we went into that fight. Fortunately, he bonused, so it gave him a good nesting there. But yeah, man, going to any of those, you know, I think it was London was like 16%. Fortunately, Moscow didn't have taxes. I think this Busan card is like 22%. So 22% right off the top, they're going to take from you. So you're basically getting, you know, a 20% pay cut going into that fight. But wow, it is what it is. You know, like, you can't control everything. The UFC is a global brand. You got to recognize that when you sign up. So you just try to do things to help to, you know, next time not, you know, let's try not to fight three fights in a row overseas. And so hopefully Jorgen's next fight will be domestic.
I know Maurice Green's already booked for a fight, and now it's on a big pay-per-view. USC 246 got a lot bigger here over the past couple of days with Conor McGregor's fight being announced. You know, obviously, you know, he went to Factory X two camps ago. What's the change you see in Maurice, you know, since going to Factory X?
Well, I think you look at his body changed. Like, you look at the after the fight a year ago, after he won against Batista on the Ultimate Fighter finale, he comes back home, and he's got a lot of distractions there. He's got a couple kids, he's got a wife, you know, so it's easy to miss a session when your kid's saying, "Daddy, saying watch a movie." And you know, you have a coach like Brock Larson, who's like the nicest person in the world, is never going to tell you no. So it's like, we realized like right away that we needed to eliminate the distractions and get him with someone that's like going to be a no bullshit type guy. And that's what Mark Montoya is. Like, he's a, I don't want to call him a dictator, but that, I mean, for lack of better terms, like he's the general there. Like, he's the guy that's, no, you show up on time or you leave. And I think that structure is really like favors Maurice. And then if you look, just even look at his body going into his last few fights, he like looks, he's leaner, he's in better shape. You know, he's got, you know, kind of a more clear mind going into the fight and understand what he's fighting for. Because you have to spend 5-6 weeks on the road, not seeing your kids, you know, motivates you to keep fighting for your kids. So, you know, we're excited to get, I think this week, this camp, he's going to do like 5 weeks, 4 or 5 weeks. It's going to end up straddling Christmas. So we're going to get him back for Christmas so he can spend time with his kids. But yeah, man, it's been a good chance, you know, good change. I think him and Mark Montoya and Brock are kind of yin and yang, you know, mm-hmm. like Brock's super laid back and kind of like give you the benefit of the doubt, where Mark's like, this is your schedule, let's stick to it, no BS. So I think it's, they both complement each other in a way that's really benefiting Maurice.
When it comes to your clients outside the UFC, you know, first off, it's Greg Rebello. You know, he's supposed to, you know, fight, what was that, last month, 2 months ago? Ultimately, you know, fight doesn't happen. What's up next for Greg?
So ideally, we're looking to defend his belt January 24th or 25th. I always forget the date, whatever that Friday is. Defend the belt for CES there. And then he says that'll be his last fight, but you never know if Greg, he's retired a couple of times at this point. So, you know, we're just looking for the right opponent with him. You know, he's 37. He's not trying to make another big run or anything like that. So he wants to go out on a big win at home in front of his family. And I think he's earned the right to do that. So, and then if he does that and then decides not to retire, he has the right to do that too. So yeah, hopefully get back in there at the end of January and get another win.
I know he's always told me one fight at a time. That's his mentality at this point. Let's take one fight at a time and see where we go from there. So we'll see what happens there. Mitch Raposo obviously is a guy that has a lot of people's eyes up there in the Northeast. You know, and I know he's looking back in January. And I know like it's kind of this like, because he's such a highly touted prospect, people are like, oh, they want that big step up in competition, that type of thing. But for you in your role, is it kind of like, you know, you're trying to make sure he's ready for when that big opportunity does come?
Yeah, I think here's the thing is like, I think sometimes people put a little too, like, obviously you need to take tough fights, and if you can't win those, you're not going to go to the big show. But at the end of the day, like, he's got a lot of qualified people around him, like, you know, like guys like his coach Brian, his coach Tommy, you know, he's got my eyes on him. He trains with Robin Calvin. He, you know, he rolls with Joe Lozon, trains with those guys. They see him in the gym. Like we can gauge in the gym. Like, we know if someone's good enough to go to the UFC. Like, now we just have to build a resume to get him there. From a skill standpoint, like, you could put him in a fight right now against a contender series level guy. You know, obviously that's a very vague statement, but you could put him in there right now and he would compete. You know, you could put him in at 125 in the UFC. He's going to make it a fight against any one of those guys. Like, obviously, he needs a little bit more experience. He's still growing into his body. But, like, that's how good he is. Like, you know, I didn't sign him as an amateur because he was a cool kid. Obviously, he's cool. But, you know, and he has phenomenal hair, I'll tell you. But, no, he's something special. Like, he's at 19, he was just as good as Rob was when Rob entered the UFC. Because that's how the landscape's changing. So, we just have to keep him, you know, make him walk before he can run. So it's like, really, we have to build his resume the right way. You know, the big knock on him was he was 6-0 as an amateur with 6 decisions. Now he's 3-0 as a pro with 3 first-round knockouts. I think he's maturing as a fighter. We've got him doing strength and conditioning at Infinite Fitness. He's getting a lot stronger. He's filling into his body. He's becoming a man. And so I think if he's not on the Contender Series next summer, like, I'd be pretty surprised. You know, we get him another win in January. I think he's the type of guy that we get to 4-0. We explain that, like, listen, like, this kid's not your average 4-0. He's special. Like, let's put him in front of Dana White and see what he thinks. Worst case, we get him to 5-0 next, you know, early winter type thing. But, I mean, that's the goal for us. You know, we sat down and talked about working together. Is like, you know, you're special, but you can't make your pro debut against a guy who's 10-1, you know? So we've gotten the right matchups. But that last fight was a test for him, you know? It was a guy that's fought some good guys. He's fought, you know, John Duma and some other top 35ers in the area. And Mitch went right through him. And, like, yeah, you could argue, like, you know, that kid's arguing was a quick stoppage or whatever. But, like, Mitch was piecing him up before that. He did drop him with a punch. It just shows how far he's come and how comfortable he is on the feet now.
Dennis Paiva, obviously, you know, I know in talking to him, he basically 35 is not really in the picture unless some notable big opportunity really comes his way. Is a 45 title fight in CES potentially in his future?
So that's the goal. Like, I don't know what's going on with Matt Bissett. I think he's kind of earned, I guess, the ability to kind of come back and have first dibs. So I don't know what's going on there. So I think that's maybe the holdup. But that was the idea originally, is like, hey, let's make his next fight a title fight. You know, he took a short notice fight on the last card just because there's some fallouts on the cards, some people falling out. So we kind of jumped in there with him and Greg to kind of help save the card a little bit. And then Greg ended up not fighting. But anyway, so that was the goal there. So that's why the last one wasn't a title fight. It was like short notice. It wasn't the right opponent on short notice to make it a title fight. But I mean, that is the goal. Like, I think he's earned the right. He's fought for CES more than anybody. You know, and just, we'll see what happens with, you know, I know Matt Bissett's looking to come back. So we'll see what they do there. But, you know, that's ideally his goal is to get that 45 title.
Final thing, mentioned two names here, Tim Caron and Devin Powell, both got wins on the Bellator show back in October at Mohegan. Is kind of the thought potentially them be on the next Mohegan show for Bellator?
Yeah, so they just told me they're coming back early winter. So the idea would be, you know, get those, ideally get Caron another win in January, whether, you know, on a local promotion, and then have him fight again in March for them. Cause I think he's, you know, he's done well for them. He's finally like at a place where he's not working a desk job anymore. He's got his own business running a personal fitness gym. And he's, you know, so he's able to work out a lot more. He's got a more of a flexible schedule. So now he can finally train like a professional athlete. Like when you saw him on the Contender Series a couple summers ago, he was working a 9-to-5 and he was like second shift. So it wasn't 9-to-5, but you know, so he's training once a day, trying to go against these guys who don't have a job. And now I'm excited to see him, you know, come back in there this winter, maybe knock off a win or two. And then, you know, whether it be if the UFC will take him back on the Contender Series or try to work out something with Bellator. But I think at 85, he's shown that he can hang with some top level talent. And then Devin Powell, yeah, same thing. Like he's, you know, at the point in his career where he wants to fight for big promotions. You know, so I know he'd love to get on that March card when they come back. And he did decent with ticket sales. And I think his fight was exciting. I think his finish was chaotic, where, you know, he put the guy to sleep with the bell and then he tried to wrestle the ref. I think he's got like 20 million views on SportsCenter. So I think he's just got something that resonates with people where they like him. He's goofy. He's organic. But he's also such a talented fighter. And I think I'm glad he finally got to show a little bit of his jiu-jitsu in that last fight, because in the UFC, all he did was stand and try to bang with everybody. So we were happy about that.
Yeah, Kevin McDonald had to show a little takedown defense in that situation.
The OG.
Yeah, but Tyson, man, as always, appreciate you coming on the show. Of course, let them know they can follow Top Game on social media and all that stuff, man.
Yeah, if you just follow my personal account, it's Tyson_Chartier. I got a link in there for Top Game's Instagram page as well. And yeah, that's really it. Just stay tuned. We post when all the guys are fighting. Next up is Rob Font next Saturday.
And there was my conversations with Ben Saunders and Tyson Chartier. Appreciate both those men giving me some time here to talk about what's going on with them. Of course, you know, Ben Saunders, Matt Brown, that should be a fun, exciting fight next week at UFC 245. And, you know, great to hear from Tyson to give the Rob Font side of the fight against Ricky Simon, which, of course, is coming up on Saturday at UFC DC. And, you know, this is a fight card that, you know, when I look at the main event, you know, and of course the main event was supposed to be Oscar Overeem versus Walt Harris. And, you know, thoughts and condolences out to Walt and his family of the tragic situation that has happened there. But in terms of this new fight with Jair Rosenstruck and Oscar Overeem, does this at all remind you of Overeem and Ngannou?
It's a very similar formula, and we've seen this formula a whole lot in the past 3 years in heavyweight fights, haven't we, Jason? Mm-hmm. It's worked out well for the people in the Ngannou spot, and it's been pulling the carpet out from under him. Obviously, when Overeem took on Ngannou, it was a very bad night for Alistair Overeem. I don't think that's going to be the case here. I think Overeem gets the win over Rosenstruck. And it's something where I have no idea what the hell's going to happen in this fight. It's as simple as that, Jason. I do not know what is going to happen. Because here, Rosenstruck, when we see him fight, he goes in there and he gets out of there real, real quick. It's less than a minute for his last two victories. When he goes in there, knocks out Alan Crowder, knocks out Andrei Arlovski. This dude's got more power than a damn Apple store. But I don't know. Overeem's halfway decent too. He's a pretty good heavyweight. And I think my gut instinct is telling me Overeem's going to be able to survive whatever initial onslaught Jair Rosenstruck goes at him. But again, this is a guessing game. You never know with these heavyweights who like start off with hell of impressive victory winning streaks, knockout win, knockout win, knockout win. The ceiling is so high you can't see it. It's like a dark room. You don't know where the ceiling is. Like you might bump your head on it real quick. So yeah, Jason, I don't know what's happening. It's just like the Ngannou fight. It's pretty simple. Is Jair Rosenstruck like the next coming of Francis Ngannou? Is he going to go out there and just be a knockout machine against everyone in the division? Alistair Overeem's a really talented, well-rounded veteran who's been through it all. Back-to-back victories. This is one hell of a test for Jair Rosenstruck.
Yeah, it's kind of that benchmark fight for Rosenstruck. You know, he is coming off that knockout win last month in 29 seconds against Andrei Arlovski. But, you know, you look at his two previous, you know, UFC fights, Alan Crowder and Junior Almini. So it is a big step up in competition. So, you know, I am interested to kind of see, you know, how does he step up? But, I mean, look, if Alistair gets the win here, he puts himself in a great position. I mean, yes, he does have some losses against the top of the UFC heavyweight division. But, you know, you win three in a row in the UFC heavyweight division, you're in a good spot.
Yeah, man, it's one of the easiest divisions in the UFC to climb, and especially if you get those victories in knockout fashion. It's pretty simple, man. You get knockouts, we want to see you fight in big time fights. Mm-hmm. And it happens in the heavyweight division. Hell, it happens at light heavyweight. I mean, look at how quickly we were willing to elevate Johnny Walker to potentially a title fight. It's a pretty simple formula, and Jair Rosenstruck is following it. You know, currently he's the 14th ranked UFC heavyweight, going up against the 6th ranked UFC heavyweight. And yeah, this is the second case we've seen of recently of a massive step up in competition for guys. We saw it with Greg Hardy against Alexander Volkov, and now we've seen it here with Jair. You know, Jair, obviously, his victory over Arlovski is pretty damn impressive. And if he knocks out Alistair Overeem, I mean, he's one fight away from a title shot. And he's one fight away from a title shot and two injuries away from a title shot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's almost like you feel like we're, you know, maybe we're a year or two away from a potential, you know, Rosenstruck versus Ngannou fight, but you know, he's got to obviously get through, you know, Alistair Overeem first. When it comes to the rest of the card, you know, I think there's several aspects of this card that do interest me. You know, you look at Aspen Ladd, how does she bounce back? And I think there's going to be a lot of tension, you know, on Friday when she weighs in after what happened in her last fight, where she just looked absolutely awful on the scale. And then of course goes out there, gets knocked out in 16 seconds. How does she bounce back taking on Yana Kunitskaya? You know, Cody Stamann against Song Yadong. I think that's a very good fight there at 135 pounds. Also, you know, Rob Font, Ricky Simon. You know, I don't, you know, look looking at that fight, I mean, you know, I think the question mark, you know, for Ricky, you know, is how does he bounce back after that loss to Uriah Faber, you know, and, you know, Rob Font, you know, this year's been a tough year for him. You just heard Tyson, you know, talking about that of, you know, fights just not coming together. You know, outside of that, I think, you know, you look at, you know, someone like a Bryce Mitchell, you know, how does he continue to develop as a fighter? You know, Thiago Alves, Tim Means, that could be a pretty fun fight to watch. And I don't know what to expect out of Rothwell and Struve.
Yeah, I think we'll be sad. Both these guys have made us sad recently, especially Struve, man. I mean, his career arc has been a depressing one. But this is a fight where both these guys have really been in the gutter for a while. And you put these two in the cage, one of them is going to be forced to get positive momentum. The Struve-Rothwell fight doesn't really excite me. The fights you mentioned do, though. I mean, Simone Font is a hell of a bantamweight contest. Stamen Song Yadong is great. Tim Means, Thiago Alves. Both these guys are definitely in the back nine of their careers. But they both have had reputations of being exciting fighters, and that's definitely something that could be the fight of the night. I mean, to me, the fight I'm looking forward to the most, Jason, is Cynthia Calvillo versus Marina Rodriguez. And I think this is just one hell of a fight between Marina Rodriguez, who's really impressed me with her victories. She is a damn good striker. She really is. And the thing about her is, like, she's going to utilize her reach to be well-rounded. Cynthia Calvillo, very good striker as well, has the ability to score takedowns and potentially go for submissions. And I think that's going to be the X factor. But this fight between Rodriguez and Calvillo in the women's strawweight division, that's actually the fight I'm looking forward to the most outside of the main event.
I feel like when it comes to Calvillo, all I've seen in terms of articles with her is her talking about Paige VanZant.
Yeah, that's true.
Like,
that's
if true. If like I was, you know, just a normal fan and, you know, I pay attention to MMA Twitter, you know, if I said, who is Cynthia Calvillo fighting? I'd probably think, oh, this guy Paige VanZant, because that's all she talks about.
She probably wishes it'd be Paige.
But what
Paige VanZant would be a lot easier fight.
Yeah, but what it ultimately is, and, you know, I can understand this, is if you're doing an interview with Cynthia Calvillo and she mentions Paige VanZant, you want that to be the title of your story because you're trying to get them clicks.
Exactly. And Marina Rodriguez isn't getting those clicks, but man, she probably should be. She's pretty good. She's looked pretty good. Her fights haven't been like the greatest fights in the world. You're not going to have any like big time memories of her fight against Tisha Torres or her win against Jessica Aguilar. But she's displayed really good skills in those fights. She's fought some tough fighters and got victories. And she's going to be a force in the strawweight division. She's a slight favorite, I think, against Cynthia Calvillo, and that speaks to where she's at in the game, and it's probably something where the expectation is she's going to shuck off those takedowns, and that to me says that the betting odds think that if this is a stand-up fight, Rodriguez is going to win it, and that's certainly a possibility for sure.
Yeah, I mean, outside of the main event, co-main event, I would say the fight that interests me the most is Stamen and Song Yadong.
Oh, dude, I mean, Song Yadong is like really exciting to watch. He has two really good finishes in UFC that really impressed me. And I think Cody Stamen will beat him in this fight. That's my general thought heading into it.
Yeah, I'm with you.
But I agree with you. Like, I like that one. I actually like Font Simone a little more. I just really have enjoyed watching Rob Font fight over the time. And Ricky Simon's been a guy who, I mean, you've interviewed him quite a bit. And I'm looking forward to that fight as well. So, I mean, to me, Font, Simon, and Song, and Stamen, those are the 1-2 fights that, like, they are at that same level for me.
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to Ricky and to Rob, I think it's a question of just how does that fight play out. I mean, I think if you're, you know, I would have to believe that, you know, the Simone team does not want to sit there and have a, just a straight kickboxing matchup. I think they want to try to mix things up. Even though last week on the show, Ricky said, you know, cause you think of Rob, you think of striking, but you know, he said, he's like, look, he's got a very good slick jiu-jitsu game. And so, you know, but I think for me, what's kind of tough to in evaluating that fight is, you know, what type of, how is Ricky going to come out? How does he come back at, you know, after losing the Faber? I mentioned this last week with Stamen. Is to me that this his fight on Saturday against Song Yudong, I get the same feeling that when he fought Tom Dukinwah, when Tom Dukinwah was this hot prospect and everyone was high on him, and Cody goes out there and wins, and you know, he said last week on the show, he's like, you know everyone was, you know, praising him, and he goes like, I'm in there with him after a couple minutes, I'm like, I'm better than this guy. This guy's not at my level. And you know, that's kind of, I mean, look, I think if you're looking to, you know, place a bet on a fight, I think you got to look at Cody Stamen at plus 170, as I have bestfightodds.com up here, Daniel. Tito Ortiz, a 11-1 favorite.
If Tito Ortiz in this point of his career is that big of a favorite, that fight should not be sanctioned. I mean, that is absurd, Jason. That is absurd.
But the thing is like, you know, UFC DC this weekend, it's a nice little get that taste of the UFC back in your mouth after not having a show for 2 weeks. But man, I'm looking forward to next Saturday night. You know, three title fights, Covington Usman, Holloway Volkanovski, Nunez de Rondame. You know, I sit there and go, is Colby Covington going to say something that next week that all of us are going to be like, oh my God?
Well, Kamaru Usman's going to try his best to keep that in check. But I think in the pre-fight hype, absolutely yes. That's now been his MO since day one.
You know, and speaking about Colby Covington, there's an article on MMAJunkie.com where Glenn Robinson's daughters have sent a message to Colby Covington: don't use our father's death to promote UFC 245. And of course, you know, Colby has said some things about Glenn, because, you know, Glenn did represent Kamaru Usman at one point. But this was a statement that Robinson's daughters made to MMA Junkie. Quote, it saddens us to even have to make a statement regarding a previous distasteful comment Colby Covington made suggesting our late father, Glenn Robinson, will be watching his upcoming fight from hell. However, after careful thought and consideration on behalf of our family, we feel it's necessary to defend our father's name. The death of our father is still very raw. Our family is still grieving from his loss. So imagine the hurt we felt to hear such hateful recklessness said about our father. We understand the excitement of building up hype before a fight, but we are sure Colby Covington can get press for his upcoming fight on his own merit and without spewing hateful words towards our father, the founder of the Black Zillions. In fact, our father was the exact opposite of a hateful person. He gave countless opportunities to many people, both personally and professionally. He consistently put everyone else's best interest before his own. Our father died too young, but we can proudly say he accomplished more during a short life than many others do in a full lifetime. Lastly, we do not want to make this statement or to breathe more life into something that truly has no relevance in our lives, but we will always defend our father, his reputation, and his name, the one we share proudly. Unfortunately, Daniel, I don't think that's going to stop Colby Covington.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, it really is. Can you imagine your father dies? You are not someone who's a part of the public sphere, and you got to make a public comment about your father who passed away a year ago.
Yeah,
man, screw you, Colby Covington. I mean, really, really, there are so many ways to promote a fight. To go there and if to read this public comment and to not immediately realize you made a mistake would be a massive, 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 you know, dick move. And hopefully Colby Covington sees this and listens. I mean, there's plenty of things to talk about, but to do it in a way where you can easily see your words have an impact on his daughters. Oh, that's disgusting. and it makes you feel gross inside.
Yeah, I don't think anything's off limits with Colby. I just think he's that's his gimmick, and he's.
The one thing he doesn't do is do entertaining fights. That's the one guarantee. You know, that's off limits. That's a little too far. Ooh, an entertaining stand-up fight. Not my cup of tea.
You know, the thing that's going to be interesting, and obviously we'll talk more about this fight next week on the show, is, you know, one of the things that Colby does is he constantly pushes the pace, you know, and you know, the question is going to be is, you know, how is that going to play out against Kamaru Usman? You know, I think there's not a, I don't have much doubt in my mind is that Kamaru Usman is the better fighter. And because of both of their grappling experiences, I do wonder, does one cancel out the other? But, you know, I would give the grappling advantage to Colby Covington, but, you know, I do wonder, will Colby struggle on the feet?
I think absolutely in this fight, for sure. Look, Covington's one hell of a talent. Usman's one hell of a talent. I think the stand-up aspect is heavily, heavily, heavily in the favor of Kamaru Usman. The question is, what's going to happen when these two wrestle each other? And I think it's going to be a standstill. I think it's going to be back and forth. And it's one hell of a fight, one hell of a card that I can't wait to see, in addition to the championship fights. I mean, Aldo versus Marlon Moraes is a great fight. And I'm looking forward to Uriah Faber's next performance against Peter Yan. I mean, he's a heavy dog there against Peter Yan. But man, that whole main card, I'm super excited for.
Yeah, I mean, it's just you talk about give me reasons to go out there and watch. I'm kind of scared to see if Jose Aldo can make 135.
Yeah, that is a big ask for sure, Jason.
I mean, this is a guy that struggled to make 145. And I mean, that's just one of those fights that, it's one of those things of like, you know, just have a fight at 145 or, you know, I mean, because Marlon is not, he is a big 135er as well. I mean, Jeff Neal, Mike Perry, I mean, which is going to be the feature prelim on ESPN2 next Saturday night. That should be a fun fight to watch. You know, we had Ben Saunders on the show earlier. And I mean, that should be a fun, you know, matchup between the two of them. Obviously, if he doesn't get the win, you know, you have to imagine that the UFC will part ways. With Ben Saunders, you know, it is interesting on the early prelims, the fact that Jessica Eye, at least on UFC.com right now, goes from fighting for the title to being the second fight of the night.
Yeah, that is a big fall. That is a big fall. And again, and not only second fight of the night, a little bit of a dog there against Vivian Araujo, plus 150.
Yeah, Chase Hooper, I think that's kind of interesting. But, yeah, I mean, you look up and down that card, and that's, we always talk about is we just want the UFC to get us excited for fight cards. And that's one of those fight cards that gets you excited. I'll be in Detroit probably freezing my butt off on Saturday night. I'll try to find somewhere to watch the fights.
Dude, it's been a while since we've had an awesome fight night. We have one with UFC 245. I mean, the last time was Diaz-Masvidal. But I'm hyped for UFC 245, man. It's going to be a great fight weekend, and it's a reminder why we love the sport.
Oh, then 2 weeks from now, we've got Ortega and the Korean Zombie. That's another fight that gets me excited.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Ortega and the Korean Zombie, that fight is sick.
That's on a Saturday morning, which actually the Bucks play that Saturday against the Texans. It's a 1 o'clock. Kickoff, so might have to throw that on the iPad while we get the booth set up before the game. But yeah, I will tell you this. We'll leave on this note. So I'm in Jacksonville last week, Daniel, and we end up in this bar where they were having a rap battle in the back of it.
Okay.
I wouldn't think Jacksonville rap battle. Just wouldn't think that. But yeah, it was very, very interesting. Cool spot, but you know, I've never been in a place where they're doing a rap battle in the back.
Was it some good rhymes?
They weren't on microphones. Like, so you really couldn't hear it, but you could hear basically, you know, what was going on. But yeah, that was it would not think Jacksonville, Florida being in a place of a rap battle.
No, absolutely not. I would be down. That's a great idea. That's a great idea for a bar scene, a rap battle culture. The rap battle night, you know, so it was like some legit battle rappers. Like, I don't want freaking Joe Blow going out there and saying like, oh, you know, Nick Foles, blah, blah, blah. No, dude, I want some legit battle rappers. That sounds entertaining as hell. Like, there's nothing like a good Yo Mama joke. And I think that's included in the battle rap. But yeah, that makes sense, man. I dig that. I feel like the one thing I would love to see at a nighttime scene is a roast. I would love to see that. So yeah, man. I feel like every time you go to these cities on the road, you always find little interesting spots. Every place you go, that or some delicious food that you send me and I get jealous of.
Yeah, it's we found one place, we had some good food there. Yeah, but yeah. Jaguars, not a good team.
Yeah. Dude, that's crazy that they benched their quarterback for Gardner Minshew that won the Super Bowl.
Well, I mean, I think it was just, you know, Foles, there's a lack of mobility. And you know, when, you know, their offensive line just, you know, is not protective, and then, you know, Gardner Minshew comes in. The crowd is, it was like second quarter, they're chanting, "We want Minshew, we want Minshew." And, you know, he's a guy that, you know, he's an athletic guy. He runs around, he extends plays, you know, and that obviously helps, but there's going to come to a point where just teams just sit there and say, "Hey, run around all you want. We're just going to cover guys." You know, mm-hmm. and make you at some point, you know, just make Minshew, you know, and but yeah, they showed a lot of money. But yeah, it was Jacksonville. I'm actually home this weekend. We played the Colts this weekend, and it's then one more road game left for me, Detroit, and then we wrap up the season with two home games. So yeah, so it's crazy, man. College football season's pretty much over at this point. You know, we got the conference title games this weekend, and yeah, before you know it, football season will be completely over.
Yeah, man. Funny story is I've been a Texans fan my entire life. That means I've had a lot of sad Sundays my entire life. It's been hard being a Texans fan. I have not had that many wins. We've had a couple playoff wins, but they've all come against the Bengals. And it's just, there's been a lot of disappointment. Every time we play a good team, we always lose. And I'm so pissed off because they were playing the Patriots this Sunday. And I decided to watch a movie instead of that game because I knew they were going to lose to the Patriots. I knew it. I knew it. We never beat Tom Brady. We don't beat good teams. We're the Texans. We get blown out 50-7 to the Ravens. I get out of the movie. I see it was like the biggest win in Texans history. I mean, that win over Tom Brady is bigger than the playoff wins. I'm sorry. But beating Tom Brady, I'm so disappointed I missed that. But, you know, that's probably the only reason they won is I didn't watch it.
Yeah. What movie did you see, though?
Oh, Ford vs. Ferrari, which.
Oh, have you seen? Okay. I've seen the trailer for Ford.
Dude, that movie's legit, dude. Like, that real, it's a real story about, like, race cars or whatever.
Yeah.
Bro, you got to watch that. That's the crazy stuff.
Like, I want to watch The Irishman, but I've heard, like, it's 4 hours long. So I'm like, okay, how many sittings are going to take me to watch this thing?
Yeah, I want to watch it too. I mean, I love that Scorsese. I love The Wolf on Wall Street, that movie that he did. Yeah, I haven't. 3 hours is just too big of a commitment, especially because like all the reviews are, it's too long. It's good, but it's too long. And yeah. It's just like, damn, if that's what people are saying about your movie. Yeah, I mean, Ford vs. Ferrari is pretty long, but dude, I would recommend that one. I mean, that one is a hell of a movie. Like, that one takes you on a ride. And, man, it, again, you're going to, like, watch this movie, and you're going to spend the next, like, hour Googling about it because you want to know more.
Yeah, it's just, like, there's so many things I want to watch. Like, I want to watch that Stone Cold Undertaker on the WWE Network. That's one of the things I want to sit there and watch. You know, it's, you know, yeah. I've seen a lot of clips of it. You know, it's one of those things where, and that's why I think where the WWE Network has this edge on UFC Fight Pass is just that there's, you know, we have, you know, two performers sitting there and talking and kind of taking you inside the business of wrestling. You know, I wish Fight Pass had that, you know?
Yeah. I think it's all about the investment you have on your product, man. I mean, WWE has a whole lot of money they are spending on the network. It had Fight, and again, to me, Fight Pass is gone. It's done. But whenever we were paying attention to Fight Pass, had they done stuff like this, I think that really would have helped extend the lifespan of it.
Yeah, I want to say it's today that they're announcing kind of the what the future of Fight Pass is, which it sounds like it's essentially what it is, but there's going to be kind of an additional paywall where the, you know, It sounds like boxing pay-per-views is where they're going to go, and maybe it's Mayweather, whatnot. But yeah, that's the one thing, because like after, you know, because I know you told me you'd watch the Austin thing, is that, you know, I went on my Fight Pass account, and I'm like, man, there's just not original programming on here that sits there and goes, oh, I want to watch that.
Yeah. Yeah, I totally, there's nothing on there that makes me want to watch it. There's nothing other than the live fights. And it's just, I haven't looked back. Once you get that ESPN Plus subscription, it's hard to justify more than ESPN Plus and DAZN.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like Saturday, I'm going to try to watch Joshua and Ruiz. I want to check out that, what's it called? One Night in whatever it's called. The one that they take a look back at the first fight. So, you know, it's one of those things, like there's so many things I want to watch, but I feel like I just don't have the time to watch all the things I want to watch.
I got one thing I saw this past week that I would recommend.
What's that?
I don't know if you've seen it. It's a big time movie, boxing documentary. It's in the 90s. It's called When We Were Kings. Have you seen that one?
No.
Dude, that one. Oh my God. That documentary was unbelievable. It came out like in, 1996, and unbelievable documentary. You need to watch it. It's about Muhammad Ali and his fight against George Foreman and Zaire.
Okay, all right.
And there's a lot of good Realm 1 the Jungle documentaries. But, dude, this movie was unbelievable, and it shows you just how to be a star. Muhammad Ali was just an unbelievable star, unlike anything we've ever seen since. The way he talked, the way – when I watch this documentary and I'm trying to like reverse engineer Muhammad Ali's mind, it seemed like he was playing a different game than everyone else. He knew what he was doing, and watching that movie, it really just – what it did was – it was a phenomenal movie, and it really just like – it reminded you that Muhammad Ali was a different cat, and that was a different time. Mm-hmm. And it's like, if you are an MMA fighter, you should watch that movie. If you think you can be a champion, watch that movie and try and steal some things from Muhammad Ali. Because Muhammad Ali was doing some things like that made him come across like a star, made him interesting, and it was all intentional. It wasn't like it was just raw stuff. I mean, this dude was playing a game. Just no one knew who he was at the time.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's, you know, it's about getting people, you know, interested in you and wanting to go out of their way to want to see you, whether we're talking about box or MMA fighter or whatever, you know, you want to go out, you know, give people a reason to want to watch you. But yeah, it's I figure like once football season ends, I'll really get to kind of catch up on all these shows and probably do some projects around the house my wife wants me to. But yeah, so, you know, look forward to the MMA this weekend. Of course, we'll be back next week as we will take a look back at what happened at UFC DC. Who knows? Maybe we talk about Ortiz and El Patrono, what happens there. And, of course, we'll be previewing UFC 245. So that's going to wrap it up for this week's edition of the MMA Report podcast, which comes out every Wednesday on RadioInfluence.com.
I'm Jerry P. Tuck, CEO of Radio Influence. I just wanted to take a quick moment to say thank you for downloading and subscribing to this podcast. There are a lot of people behind the scenes here at Radio Influence that work hard to keep you entertained day in and day out. If you'd like to get involved and advertise on this program, or you have some show ideas that you'd like to see us add to the Radio Influence family, please email us at contact@radioinfluence.com. We all have crazy schedules, so the fact that you took time out of your busy day to let us entertain you for a while means a lot. Without you, the listeners, we wouldn't exist, so thank you again for downloading and subscribing to this show. Don't forget to check out radioinfluence.com to see what other shows we also have to offer. All of Radio Influence's programming can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and of course, radioinfluence.com.